Welcome to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform with your host, Rob Virchik.
Hi, everyone. Today we'll be talking about food security policy and the impacts of climate change. My guest is Lori Restino. Lori recently joined the Center for Progressive Reform as a member scholar. She is the inaugural director of the Center for Agriculture and Food Systems at Vermont Law School and an associate professor there. Before joining Vermont Law School, Lori served as a lawyer for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in the administrations of George W. Bush and Barack Obama. She's the co-author and editor of a comprehensive book on conservation easements titled A Changing Landscape, The Conservation Reader. To start our conversation about how climate impacts might affect food security, I asked Lori to explain what food security is.
The classic definition, or the one that's really accepted out there, is the FAO definition, which really defines food security in terms of four pillars: availability. I'm actually looking at it right now. Availability, access, utilization, and governance. And I think that's really helpful because it's actually what I kind of consider to be an operational concept, which means we can use that definition to really help us achieve ideas of food security or a state of food security. And I think that's important. So in developing countries, the problem is generally that there's not enough, that there is a shortage of food or good food or healthy food. And in developed countries or wealthy countries, relatively speaking, like ours, food security is often the lack of good and healthy food, or healthy food that allows people to live full and healthy lives. So we might have enough calories in America, but they might be very bad calories. And we're actually seeing that with diseases that are food related, like cardiac, diabetes, things like that, that are really shortening the lifespan of certain parts of our population significantly.
Is climate change affecting food security in the United States? I know we hear about it in the news, how cyclones or heat waves or droughts might be affecting food production, let's say, in sub-Saharan Africa or in Southeast Asia that's prone to so many floods. Do we have reason in the United States to be concerned?
Absolutely. I think the ways they manifest, though, are different generally than what you'd see in a country that's developing than you see here, because obviously we have enough money and to import the things that we need ultimately. But I think when you looked at what happened with Puerto Rico, the devastation there, I mean, certainly food security in general was wiped out. And I think islands in particular, both islands near us and islands globally, can be impacted in the short term with those kind of extreme events. But in the continental U.S., I think what we're seeing is really long-range impacts to food security. And those, and like in the West is a great example where we're seeing, you know, increased temperatures and more drought and not enough water and population growth. So there's, and I wouldn't even say that's a long range thing. I mean, that's here. I think what's happening in America is there's been a real reluctance. California is a great example of that, to really address the limits of our environment when it comes to food production or agriculture production, which, you know, goes beyond just food production.
So water scarcity issues, and I suppose that's related to extremes in precipitation, where sometimes we don't get as much precipitation as we had expected or that we had in the past. And I suppose in the West, it's about snowmelt too, isn't it? Because if you don't have the snow, the large snows in the wintertime holding essentially the frozen water up in the mountains so that when it melts, it comes down at the right time in the spring, that they lose out with irrigation, I suppose.
So I think that there's the issues with the climate change and food security out West, when it, in terms of water, it is complicated. So it is the reduction generally of snowpacks, but also the irrigation of, you know, or the, you know, pulling of water for both agriculture irrigation as well as growing cities out West. You know, just take aside snowpacks is an increasing issue because you're having less precip in general. And that's what's going to happen in the West because of climate change, or what it's actually happening in the West because of climate change. And then, you know, I think there's a compounding factor of extreme weather events. So we saw, you know, in 2012, the general drought that impacted other states as well, not just West, but the Midwest. And then we're just seeing extreme weather events that can wipe out an entire crop. We had that with the hurricane here in Vermont, which just blew out an entire, at least one season, and in some farms more than that. And in general, what we're seeing in really the Northeast is an increase of precipitation. I see that in my own life. I was born in New England and coming back here. And just looking at the winters, the skies used to be blue a lot when I was growing up, but now because of the increased moisture in the atmosphere that we've put up there because of climate change, we actually don't have a lot of clear days. It's kind of reminding me now in New England of the Pacific Northwest. I mean, the temperatures are colder, although they are less cold than they were when I was growing up.
Well, I know in some parts of the world, including the United States, scientists project longer growing seasons for certain crops. Seems like that would be a good thing.
You know, that's a really interesting question, and it's complicated because there will be parts of the globe that will see increased production and increased yields. There's some debate about whether or not those yields will be as nutritionally beneficial. Once you change one thing, you change a lot of things. So that kind of remains to be seen. But with those gains in some parts of the world, there will be declines that will be devastating other places, especially what we'll primarily see actually growth in yield and growth in precip in places where there isn't a big population. So parts of Russia, you know, northern parts of North America, parts of Mongolia, but then places in Southeast Asia, Sub-Saharan, you know, South America, Central America, we're going to be seeing declines. And, you know, coincidentally, those are the places with growing global population. So in some ways, it's kind of a recipe for disaster, which is why talking about food security on a global scale, talking about how yields will be impacted both positively and negatively, and we're also be seeing both declines in fisheries in certain parts of the world, which I think generally kind of track growths and declines in yields. And so this is really important. In fact, the Department of Defense a couple of years ago actually had a report about climate change and really our national security, and noted the fact that really impacts to food security in different parts of the world will destabilize the certain cultures, but that can also have a negative impact on America's security. So these things are all complicated, but they're very much tied together. And so being aware of food security and planning for these changes, these anticipated changes in yields, is, I think, really critical on a global scale.
What do we know about invasive species in the United States and climate change? Are we worried more about pests or other kinds of blight on crops, or weeds and insects and other species that might compete with our ability to grow crops?
All the above. Can I say that? The pictures, there's not a lot of good news here. I mean, it's true that in some places yields will increase, but it's like anything, we're talking about complex systems. And when you start changing things, there are unintended consequences. And I think pathogens and weeds and invasives, which we battle with now, we have for quite a while, introduced species, as well as resistance that we've done to ourselves because of using, you know, Roundup Ready soybeans and corn and are the majority of those are our largest crops, actually. Commodity crops are corn and soy, as you probably know, and the vast majority of those are genetically altered so that they can withstand pesticides like glyphosate, which is used ubiquitously in the United States. And now we have, of course, resistant weeds because Mother Nature is way smarter than we'll ever be. And so what you have to do is then combine it with other pesticides because you have to get the stuff that's resistant when you get into that cycle. So yes, we have our own resistance and pathogen issue that we brought on ourselves by monocropping and losing diversity, and by using inputs that really end up selecting for things that can survive those inputs. And then we have, you know, the broader issues of the change in temperatures and the change in yield and precips that come with that are also factors. And I used to also be an attorney for the Forest Service. And as you might know, the USDA often includes forests, private forests, under the broad definition of agriculture. And when I was an attorney for them over a decade ago, it was clear that the forests were really suffering from increased pathogens and blight, which would cause massive die-offs. And of course, especially if you're out west, that can cause massive, massive fires, which also can contribute to, you know, global warming and losing that carbon sequestration. And when even a decade ago, they were starting to plan for assisted succession. So putting new types of species that could withstand the different kind of climate that was emerging. And I do think some of that's important. The same thing for species and assisted migration, because things will get warmer and species won't be able to exist there. But then as I said before, these are complex systems, and they do interact and I think impact fundamental natural resources.
I want to ask you a little bit on the policy side about this, because I was in the Obama administration in the first term at the EPA, and I remember talking with folks at USDA, both in the Forest Service and folks in other parts of USDA concerned about agricultural policy producing food. And there was a fair amount of discussion at USDA about climate impacts. And I know that, of course, you've spent much of your career at the USDA. Can you tell me a little bit about, sort of at the staff level, at the career level, what the awareness is of climate impacts, and what were some of the ways that the USDA was thinking of approaching or addressing that issue?
Oh, absolutely. It's a really great question, because now, of course, we're back to an overarching administrative kind of policy where at least climate change isn't something we need to worry about, or there are deniers in the administration. I remember during the second Bush administration, for most of it, where we weren't allowed to really talk about climate change in official policy, although I remember working with the Forest Service and them realizing very clearly that they had to start planning for things, that they had to find really top genetic sources of seedlings for trees. They had needed to plan that kind of succession. They were looking at salmon populations declining in the Northwest and assisted migration. So they were looking at increased pathogens. So even though they couldn't talk about it publicly, they were planning for it, because I think they deeply understood, and they recognized the responsibility to do so. I have to say, on the agriculture side, I think it's been slower, in part because, although obviously I think the people at NRCS, the Natural Resources Conservation Service, I've never heard them denying climate change. But I think the tremendous pressure on the department from often traditional commodity groups, they have to really walk a line. But having said that, I found that most of the scientists there that I worked with, they certainly understood how climate change was changing things, especially in NRCS. But the line they had to walk was when most of the environmental protection or the conservation we're trying to get done with agriculture is voluntary, they have to work with producers in a voluntary way and get as many gains as they can. And oftentimes the term climate change was a dirty word. So how can you get the kind of conservation benefits you need to make the necessary gains and not be controversial? And it's a really tough job. And I think a lot of the federal folks who were outside the USDA didn't always understand kind of the culture and the line some of those federal officials at the USDA had to walk.
You're listening to CPR's Connect the Dots. My guest today is Laurie Restino of Vermont Law School. I'll return to my interview after this short break.
Catherine Jones here. If you like what you're hearing today, drop us a line, give us your thoughts, or just sign up for our emails, which we promise to send sparingly. And if you really think our environment, health, and regulatory safety net is worth fighting for, we'd gladly appreciate a donation. As operations manager for the Center for Progressive Reform, I can tell you that everything we do, like this podcast, is supported 100% by donation from folks like you who care. Thanks for listening and being here to connect the dots with us.
You're listening to CPR's Connect the Dots. I'm Rob Virchik. My guest today is Laurie Restino of Vermont Law School. Laurie, I want to ask you about the upcoming 2018 Farm Bill, which you've been writing about in blog posts for CPR recently. It seems every 4 or 5 years we hear about the Farm Bill in the news and the debates in Congress, but I'm not sure many people really know what the Farm Bill is. Can you explain the importance of the Farm Bill and how it affects everyday Americans?
Yeah, it is really important. It's a beast, you know. It's like you said, it's a piece of legislation that comes around 4 or 5 years. And right now we're in what they call a Farm Bill year. So Congress is starting to debate the legislation. It's because it will expire this year. Now, whether we'll actually get one or not this year, it remains to be seen. The last Farm Bill, which was passed in 2014, was heavily debated. And it's important because it has so many different policies and so much funding, although not as much as, say, like Department of Defense, but I think for rural America, as well as for folks in urban areas or people who need supplemental nutrition assistance, which used to be called food stamps, it's really important. It also has money in there for conservation on farmland or agriculture land. And what most people don't realize is we're still largely a rural nation. And so having a healthy America environmentally really means that we need conservation on those working lands. So that piece of the Farm Bill is incredibly important. So Farm Bill is a misnomer. It's really, I call it an American bill. It's an omnibus piece of legislation that creates new law and amends existing law. And it also is interesting because it actually essentially appropriates funding. So it doesn't have to go through an appropriations process every year. So it is an incredibly important vehicle for American policy. And I think that people are starting to slowly realize that, especially people getting interested in food. The Farm Bill used to be a black box that really only a few stakeholder groups and interest groups would wade into every 4 or 5 years. And because of that, they knew it quite well and knew how to run the traps. But now I think that you're seeing increased interest. What I'm hoping is that from other groups, like from environmental groups, from good food groups, from social justice groups. But what I really hope is that those folks stay engaged and they become very educated on the deep policy implications so that we can move the Farm Bill forward into a new age.
Now, tell me, how does the Farm Bill, or how will this new Farm Bill, do you think, attempt to ensure food security in a time of increased temperatures, more extreme weather, larger potential for storms?
And the short answer would be it won't. And it will essentially be a huge lost opportunity. I know, I wish I could be more positive about it, but that's, in my estimation, that's what's going to happen. What I'm hoping for, I think our best case scenario right now for the Farm Bill is A, that SNAP doesn't get cut significantly. SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, it's actually the biggest part of the Farm Bill. It used to be that the coalition that would pass the Farm Bill were essentially more liberal urban representatives and senators, and then the rural, more conservative Congress persons would all come together and they would pass it because both of them got things out of the bill. But we saw, I thought it was pretty incredible, the last farm bill, that traditional coalition really fell apart. And so especially Democrats were really fighting to keep decent levels of SNAP fundings. It got caught, but it didn't get cut as much as it would have been. Still, it's really not enough money. So one of my concerns from a policy perspective and from a good food and just a human decency perspective is that we don't see significant cuts and that the SNAP is fully restored in terms of funding and that we don't lose ground on conservation and that we see a more rational crop insurance, which is our main safety net now for farmers and producers. We see a more rational program that really tiers or connects crop insurance to good farming practices. That's where I think we could see gains in really making America more food secure. Right now, I think we have a rather irrational policy of crop insurance, and that's not good for the taxpayers. We actually underwrite crop insurance premiums. Over 60% of those premiums, significant cost to the American taxpayer. And we really need to encourage better practices so that we can have the kind of healthy natural resource systems on land in order to really lay the foundation for a food secure future.
Well, I'm interested in this conflict that you write about in one of your blog posts about which is about what you just mentioned, the conflict between, or at least I'll say the tension that is between the crop insurance program and conservation incentives. And it would seem to me that if I were a farmer and looking at the future of climate change, I would be very interested in crop insurance, right? Because I would be thinking to myself, well, if there's a drought or if there are some new kinds of pests or blight that are going to strike my crops that might be related to climate change, I want some assurance from the federal government that I'll be able to continue. So can you explain to me how crop insurance and, in fact, subsidized crop insurance can run counter to incentives for a farmer to use innovative mechanisms to conserve soil and preserve water use and things like that?
Crop insurance is a huge benefit, but yet we don't require farming practices that build resilience. And in fact, those farmers who, say, plant on, say, highly erodible soils or soils that really aren't best suited for commodity crops will end up really being subsidized more by crop insurance because of the risky planting practices. So, and that just doesn't make good business sense for the United States or for the taxpayer. So we actually could use crop insurance as an effective tool to increase better farming practices that really would build resilience, but we don't. And we could, you know, another way to put this is we could use crop insurance to reward farmers who use good practices and reduce their planting risks. And we could say to farmers that don't, hey, we're not going to underwrite you. This should be an emergency provision, essentially, crop insurance. It shouldn't be a provision that really perpetuates a system where you're not improving really your resilient practices, your good conservation practices, and we're essentially guaranteeing you a rate of return, say if the commodity prices aren't as high as they've been historically. And to me, that isn't a safety net. That is a kind of guarantee that you wouldn't get in any other business line in America. So why are we doing that? And I think a part of the reason why we're doing that is because most Americans have no clue how crop insurance works. And they don't open the hood of our farm safety net policy to really understand that. But I, like I said before, what I'm really hoping is that people start to get engaged in these policies and that we really start to use the farm bill as a tool to move America toward a kind of more sustainable farming systems instead of locking farmers in to a kind of production that is honestly not sustainable in the long run and keeps, they're not, I think I said in one of my blog posts, it's not exactly golden handcuffs, but if you get payment to not change your business, if it mutes market signals, then why would you do it? You'd have to have this Herculean effort almost, or this huge desire to say, want to get into organic grains or something, which actually are getting, are receiving a premium in traditional conventional commodity crops. Have been have not had a great rate of return over the last couple of years. So we're doing something that, you know, with all the rhetoric of America and allowing business and free and open markets, is runs completely contrary to that. And actually, we've been doing this since the 1930s, you know, since the Dust Bowl, since FDR. But that doesn't mean that we have to still continue to do it. And my argument would be that we can little afford to not really look at the so-called farm safety net and really ask ourselves, is this really safe? Is it really encouraging a kind of agriculture that's going to take us into the next 100 years?
You know what this reminds me of, this issue of crop insurance, is I spent a lot of time, as you may know, in researching disaster in cities on coasts, and it reminds me of the National Flood Insurance Program, which, of course, is in debt, multi-billions. And one of the criticisms against the National Flood Insurance Program, as you know, is that it subsidizes insurance for people who are living in areas that really are flood-prone and maybe are not places that should be developed or should have people to continue to live, at least in the ways that they do. And it's the same kind of tension, it seems. I mean, we don't want to drive people out of their homes. We don't want to render people's homes valueless by saying you can't afford flood insurance and therefore you won't be able to sell your house. But at the same time, there has to be some kind of an incentive for people who are living in floodplains, either to act differently, to shore up their houses in a way that would prevent large harm during storms, or that might give them some incentive at some point to cash out and move to a better place. And the problem in the National Flood Insurance Program is that it too was designed to have an incentive that would encourage people to do the right thing, whether it's elevating their houses or floodproofing their houses in some way, in exchange for cheaper premiums. And it sounds like the same thing that you're saying, is that we could condition affordable or generous insurance, we could condition that insurance on best practices, and that might push us towards some kind of resilience in that area.
Yeah, well, exactly. But I think the other thing is, from a business perspective, it's like when you determine risk, when you do the actuarial, you know, stats, it's like that's how insurance works. It's like you should have higher premiums if you're engaging in risky behaviors. And if you're actually engaging in behavior that reduces your risk, you should have lower premiums, right? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. But what I would suggest is that we have limited resources in America. We're willing to not pay for supplemental nutrition or food stamps for people who can't afford to eat well, but then we're willing to subsidize business practices or practices of living and engaging in resources that are completely unsustainable. And it really doesn't make much sense.
Laura, you're talking to us from Vermont Law School, where I know you have a booming program on food law and policy. You've got lots of students interested in studying in that area, and it seems this is part of a trend. I see this in New Orleans, where I live, where law students, but also undergraduates, are very interested in food policy. They want to know how crops are grown, how fish are caught. They're interested in labor issues associated with agriculture and food production, and they want to know about food safety and consumption patterns. Tail to snout, as we say, down in New Orleans, and farm to table. What do you think, Lori, this is? Why are people so interested in learning about the food system these days?
Sure. What, such a great question. Yeah, it is interesting because, you know, when we went to law school, this didn't exist. In fact, you know, I actually went to Iowa, and it was more conventional, although Iowa's a progressive law school. But so it was more conventional. It was more like regular contracts and, you know, the crop insurance law and trading on the markets, things like that. But this is a totally different thing. And I think gaining legitimacy, food law and policy really started probably about a decade or so ago. I actually think our brand of what we teach here at Vermont Law School is broader than food law and policy. That does focus more on food safety and food policy. We're interested in agriculture as well as the intersection to animal law and things that have other doctrinal areas that have existed for a while. It's both challenging and lovely because it is in a neat box, but I think actually the growth of this area is reflective of our acknowledgement of the complexity of the world and the legal issues, obviously, that exist, and that we need to use law and policy and in more nuanced systems-based manner so that we can actually make progress. So this area emerging in all its forms and different aspects and dimensions is really, I think, reflective of that. I don't think it will ever be neat, but I think that's okay because life's not neat.
Well, Lori, thanks so much for talking to me today.
It's been a wonderful pleasure. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, everyone, for listening today. I'm Rob Virchik. My guest today has been Lori Restino of Vermont Law School. And that sprightly piano playing is from Lobo Loco.
You've been listening to Connect the Dots podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. We're a legal policy center helping to build healthy communities, safe workplaces, and a more resilient planet. Check us out and subscribe to our podcast by visiting our website, www.progressivereform.org. Thanks. See you there.